Whispers from the Dark, Season 2, Episode 3, with Raven Vale. When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. The Gates of Pluton, Rome's real-life portal to the underworld. There is a place in this world where death does not need to be imagined. It does not need to be theorized. It does not need to be interpreted through myth or metaphor or religious parable. It simply happens. Instantly. Inevitably. Without warning or mercy. In ancient Rome, there was a doorway so lethal that birds dropped dead in mid-flight as they passed over it. Not injured. Not struggling. Dead. Falling from the sky like stones. A place where animals collapsed without wounds. Without violence. Without any visible cause. Where the ground itself seemed poisoned by something invisible. Something that killed on contact. Where priests could walk unharmed, while everyone else died. Not sometimes, not occasionally, every time, consistently, predictably, as if death itself had rules, had preferences, had chosen sides, a place so undeniably dangerous that the Romans, who conquered the known world, who bent nations to their will, who believed human engineering could overcome any obstacle, did not deny it. They didn't dismiss it as superstition. They didn't try to explain it away as coincidence or natural occurrence. They didn't attempt to conquer it or control it or turn it into something useful. They named it. They marked it. They built around it. They incorporated it into their understanding of the world. They called it Plutonian, the Gate of Pluto, the Gate of Hades. A literal entrance to the underworld, not symbolic, not metaphorical, literal. And unlike legend, unlike myth, unlike the countless stories humans tell to explain what they don't understand, this one was real. Documentably, observably, measurably real. This is Whispers from the Dark. Season 2. I'm Raven Vale. Tonight, we're going to talk about a place where myth and reality overlap so perfectly that even modern science, with all its instruments and understanding, struggles to explain why ancient people were right, why their conclusions, drawn without chemistry or geology or physics, aligned perfectly with what we now know to be true. A place that kills without touching, without sound, without visible mechanism. A place the Romans believed was a doorway to hell, and a place that, disturbingly, still works, still kills, still breathes death into the air after 2,000 years. The Gates of Pluton were located in the ancient city of Hierapolis, near modern-day Pamukkale in southwestern Turkey. This was not a remote village, not some forgotten outpost at the edge of the empire. Not a place whispered about in legends, but never visited. It was a thriving Roman city, one of the great spa cities of the ancient world, famous for its hot springs, its healing waters, its thermal baths that drew the wealthy and the sick from across the Mediterranean, a center of commerce, religion, and healing. Thousands of people lived there. Tens of thousands passed through it. Merchants traded goods. Pilgrims sought healing. The elite built villas. It was prosperous, sophisticated, connected to every major city in the empire by well-maintained roads. And yet, in the heart of this civilized place, there was one location no one entered casually. One spot everyone knew, everyone avoided, everyone respected, with a fear that transcended normal caution. A stone cave at the base of a hillside, small, unassuming from a distance. You could walk past it without noticing if you didn't know it was there. The entrance was maybe 6 feet wide, 8 feet tall, maybe 12 feet deep from entrance to back wall. Nothing impressive architecturally. No grand columns, no elaborate carvings, no statuary, no decoration of any kind. Just an opening in the rock, raw stone, rough walls, a simple threshold between the world of the living and something else. But deadly. Absolutely. Undeniably deadly. Not theoretical danger. Not potential risk. Actual, observable, consistent death. The kind of danger you could demonstrate. The kind of killing you could predict. Stand here with this animal. It dies. Every time. Without exception. Without variation. Ancient writers described it with absolute certainty, not with the vague language of myth, not with the cautious qualifiers of rumor, not with the embellishment of legend, with the precision of eyewitnesses reporting what they had personally observed, what they had tested, what they had measured in the most direct way possible, with lives. Strabo, a Roman geographer writing in the 1st century BCE, documented it carefully, methodically, with the attention to detail you'd expect from someone trained in observation and measurement. He wrote that any animal brought near the opening would collapse instantly, not gradually, not over time, instantly, as if struck by invisible force. Birds flying over it would fall dead out of the sky, mid-flight, wings still extended, dropping like stones. Spectators would watch birds approach, see them suddenly go limp, watch them plummet to the ground, dead before they hit Earth. The air itself, Strabo said, was lethal. You couldn't see it, couldn't smell it, couldn't taste it, couldn't detect it with any human sense. But it killed, reliably, consistently. Anyone who stood too close for too long would begin to feel faint, would struggle to breathe, would collapse if they didn't retreat immediately. Invisible. Unavoidable. Inescapable once you were in it. Like drowning in air. Like being smothered by nothing. Strabo didn't speculate. He didn't theorize. He didn't offer explanations. He observed. He recorded. He reported what he saw with his own eyes, what he tested with his own experiments, what he confirmed through multiple visits. And he wasn't alone. Pliny the Elder, the Roman naturalist who died investigating Mount Vesuvius, wrote about the gates of Pluton, described the same phenomenon, the same instant death, the same invisible mechanism. Cassius Dio, the Roman historian, referenced it in his chronicles, treated it as established fact, as something everyone knew about, as noteworthy as any other geographic feature of the empire. Multiple independent Roman sources, separated by decades, sometimes centuries, described the same phenomenon. This was not myth passed through generations, distorted by retelling, embellished by imagination. This was contemporary reporting, direct observation. Multiple witnesses across multiple time periods, all confirming the same basic facts. Something in that cave killed living beings on contact. Something invisible. Something consistent. Something that operated by rules no one fully understood. But everyone could observe. And everyone knew it. From the richest senator to the poorest slave. From the most educated philosopher to the most superstitious peasant. The gates of Pluton were real. The danger was real. The deaths were real. The most disturbing detail, the thing that separated this from simple natural hazard, wasn't that the cave killed. Plenty of places in the ancient world were dangerous. Cliffs, swift rivers, volcanic vents, dangerous animals. The world was full of ways to die. It was that some people could enter and survive. Not by luck, not by chance, but deliberately, repeatedly, as if they possessed knowledge that negated the danger. Priests of Pluto, known as the Galli, would walk directly into the cave and emerge alive, not just once, not as a single dramatic demonstration, regularly, as part of religious ceremonies, as part of public rituals that drew crowds. Spectators watched in horror as animals were led to the entrance, watched them take those final steps, watched them cross the invisible threshold, watched them collapse, watched them die, watched death happen in real time. Not abstract, not distant, right there in front of them, immediate, unavoidable, undeniable. And then watched in amazement, in awe, in fear, as the priests walked past the dead animals, stepped over the bodies, walked into the cave, into the space where death had just proven itself, stood inside the entrance where death pooled like water, stood there for what must have felt like an eternity to observers. 30 seconds. A minute. However long it took to complete the ritual. And then walked out. Alive. Unharmed. Breathing normally, as if nothing had happened. No injuries. No signs of distress. No coughing or gasping or weakness. They emerged as casually as if they'd stepped into an ordinary temple, as if death itself had simply chosen not to notice them. No explanation that made sense to observers. No visible protection, no special equipment, no amulets or charms that could account for their survival. Just priests entering a place that killed everything else and emerging unharmed. The Romans believed this was proof of divine favor. Proof that the priests were protected by Pluto himself, that the god of the underworld had marked these men as his servants, had granted them immunity to the breath of death, that faith, devotion, ritual purity somehow created a barrier between them and the invisible killer. But there was something else happening, something the priests understood, but never explained. Something they kept carefully secret because the mystery was part of their power, part of their authority, part of what made them necessary. The priests knew when to enter. They didn't go in at random times. They went at specific hours, usually dawn, usually when the air was still cool, when conditions were right. They knew where to stand, not deep in the cave. Just inside the entrance, specific spots, specific distances, as if they'd mapped the invisible geography of death. And they knew how long they could remain. They didn't linger, didn't test their limits. They entered, performed their ritual, and exited. Quickly, efficiently, before the danger became unavoidable. Which suggests this wasn't magic. It wasn't divine protection. It wasn't faith overcoming reality. It was knowledge, practical, observational, carefully accumulated knowledge, dangerous knowledge, knowledge that probably killed several priests before the survivors learned the patterns, before they figured out the rules, before they understood which variables mattered and which didn't. Think about what it took to acquire that knowledge. Think about the experimentation required. Someone had to test the boundaries. Someone had to enter at different times. Someone had to stand in different positions. Someone had to time how long they could remain. And someone had to fail, had to push too far, had to stand too long, had to crouch at the wrong moment, had to breathe at the wrong time, and died learning what not to do. They understood something about the cave that spectators couldn't see, couldn't measure with the instruments available to them, couldn't replicate without guidance and training and practice, and they used that knowledge to create the illusion of divine favor, to reinforce their authority, to demonstrate their special relationship with the god, to maintain their position as intermediaries between the living and the dead. Modern scientists eventually uncovered what the Romans could not explain with words, what the priests understood intuitively, but never articulated, what killed so efficiently and so invisibly. The cave sits atop a geological fault line, a crack in the earth that extends deep into the crust, and from that fault, volcanic gases rise, specifically carbon dioxide, CO2, the same gas we exhale with every breath, the same gas that makes carbonated beverages fizz, harmless in small concentrations, deadly in large ones. CO2 is heavier than oxygen, heavier than nitrogen, heavier than the normal atmospheric gases we breathe, which means it doesn't disperse easily. It doesn't rise, it pools, it flows like water, it fills low spaces, it accumulates in enclosed areas. In the cave at Hierapolis, CO2 emerges from the fault constantly, steadily, flowing out like an invisible river, pooling at the bottom of the cave, spreading across the floor, creating a layer of unbreathable air that sits close to the ground. Animals, shorter than humans, closer to the ground, died instantly. Their noses, their mouths, their breathing apparatus, all positioned in the layer of pure CO2. They inhaled gas instead of air. No oxygen reached their lungs. They suffocated standing up. Suffocated in what looked like open air. Suffocated so quickly they didn't have time to struggle or flee. Birds flying low, dipping down to investigate the cave or the gathering crowd, entered the CO2 layer. Their wings were still beating. They were still trying to fly. But no oxygen reached their brains. They went unconscious, mid-flight. Plummeted. Dead or dying before they hit the ground. Humans entering without knowledge collapsed. Those who bent down to examine fallen animals, who knelt to get a closer look, who crouched to avoid low ceilings, positioned their faces in the deadly layer. Breathed pure CO2. Lost consciousness within seconds. Died within minutes, if not dragged out. The priests survived because they understood the stratification. They stayed upright, kept their heads above the invisible line where CO2 gave way to breathable air. They held their breath when necessary. They knew to take shallow breaths. They moved carefully. They didn't panic. They didn't crouch or kneel or make sudden movements that might lower their heads into the death zone. They knew the rhythms, knew that gas concentration varied by time of day. At night, when the air cooled, CO2 pooled more densely, filled more of the cave, rose higher, became more dangerous. At dawn, when warming air created circulation, when breezes moved the gas, concentrations were lower. The deadly layer was thinner. Survival was more likely. They knew the invisible geography of death, knew which spots near the entrance had better airflow, which positions were safest, where to stand, where not to stand. Information gathered over generations, information that cost lives to acquire, information carefully guarded and passed only to initiated priests. Modern measurements confirm everything the ancient sources described. CO2 concentrations at ground level in the Plutonian reach levels that would kill a human in under a minute. Concentrations that would cause unconsciousness in seconds. At head height for a standing adult, concentrations are lower, still dangerous with prolonged exposure, but survivable for brief periods. Science explains the mechanism. Chemistry explains the deaths. Geology explains the source. We understand how it works. We can measure it, predict it, model it. We've solved the mystery. But science does not explain the choices, does not explain why this became sacred, does not explain why the Romans responded the way they did. Here's the question that matters. Out of every deadly place on Earth, out of every natural hazard, every dangerous phenomenon, every location where death was common, why did this one become the official entrance to the underworld? Carbon dioxide vents exist elsewhere. Yellowstone has them. Italy has them. Iceland has them. Volcanic regions worldwide release CO2 from geological faults. It's not unique. It's not even particularly rare. Volcanic gas releases exist elsewhere. Sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, methane, all deadly, all invisible, all capable of killing without warning. But only here, only at Hierapolis, did the ancient world unanimously agree this is a doorway. This is the boundary. This is where the living world ends and the realm of the dead begins. Why? What made this place special? What made this specific vent different from all the others? The answer lies in behavior, in how the gas moved, how it acted, how it appeared to observers who didn't understand chemistry but understood patterns, who could watch and measure and predict even without knowing the underlying mechanism. The gas didn't drift randomly. It didn't disperse unpredictably. It didn't behave like smoke or fog or any other visible phenomenon they could compare it to. It moved like breath, like something inhaling and exhaling. It rose and fell, not constantly, not steadily, but rhythmically, in cycles that could be observed and predicted. It surged and receded. There would be periods when the cave seemed less dangerous, when animals could approach closer before showing distress, when the priests could stand longer. And then it would change. The danger would intensify. The killing zone would expand, as if whatever lived in the cave was waking up, becoming more active, breathing more strongly. It followed rhythms, daily cycles tied to temperature changes, seasonal patterns tied to weather, long-term variations tied to geological activity deep underground. Patterns that ancient observers could learn even without understanding why they existed. It behaved like something alive, like something conscious, like something that could be predicted but not controlled, like something with moods and patterns and preferences, like something with intention, even though we now know it was purely mechanical, purely physical, purely the result of gas density and temperature and pressure. And most importantly, most disturbingly, most convincingly to ancient observers, it punished without warning, without mercy, without regard for status or intention or faith. No fire that you could see approaching, no smoke that signaled danger, no sound that alerted you to retreat, no visible threat that let you prepare or defend. Just sudden death. Instant transition from life to nothing, to ancient people, to observers who didn't have chemistry or understand gases or know about molecular weight or density or the behavior of different atmospheric compounds. This wasn't poison. Poison had to be administered, had to be delivered, had to make contact with the victim. You had to drink it, eat it, be stabbed with it, be touched by it. Poison was something you could see coming, something you could avoid if you were careful, something that required proximity or contact or contamination. This was different. This was presence. This was entity. This was something inhabiting the cave, something invisible but undeniably real, something that occupied space, something that killed by proximity alone. by attention, by awareness, by choosing victims, or so it seemed to people who watched it work, who saw pattern and intention in what was actually mechanical process. When you watched birds fall from the sky, when you saw animals collapse without being touched, without being attacked, without any visible cause of death, when you witnessed death happening in open air with no weapon, no violence, no contact, the conclusion was obvious. The conclusion was logical, given the available evidence and the framework available for understanding the world. This place is inhabited. This place is occupied. This place belongs to something else. Something powerful. Something invisible. Something that doesn't want us here. Something that enforces boundaries with lethal efficiency. Something that kills intruders automatically, without hesitation, without mercy. And if something lives here, if something occupies this space with such lethal efficiency, then what is it? What could kill without form? What could be present without body? What could enforce territory without physical force? The only answer that made sense within their understanding of reality: this is a god's domain. This is where Pluto, god of the underworld, god of the dead, maintains a presence in the living world. This is his gate, his entrance, his doorway between realms. Not metaphor, fact. Observable, testable, repeatable fact. The gates of Pluton were not hidden, not kept secret, not restricted to initiated few. They were public. They were ritualized. They were incorporated into the civic and religious life of Hierapolis. Animals were brought before crowds, led to the entrance in full view of spectators who gathered to witness, sacrificed publicly, not behind closed doors, not in private ceremonies. Public demonstrations of the power of the underworld. The priests demonstrated that power, showed that the boundary between life and death was real, was physical, was measurable in steps and distance. They walked to the edge, crossed it, survived, returned. Proof that they had special knowledge, special favor, special access to something ordinary people couldn't approach. Rome did not shy away from death. Roman culture was comfortable with mortality, with violence, with public executions and gladiatorial combat and spectacular displays of killing. Death was entertainment, was political statement, was social reinforcement. And yet, even for Rome, even for a culture that treated death as spectacle, this place was treated with caution, with respect, with a wariness that bordered on fear. No permanent structures were built inside the cave. The temple was outside. The altars were outside. The gathering spaces were outside. Inside was left to the gas, to the invisible presence, to Pluto. No one lingered. Priests entered and exited, quickly, purposefully. No one set up camp. No one tried to occupy the space. No one attempted to make it useful, or comfortable, or accessible. No one challenged it. No emperor ordered it conquered. No engineer proposed draining it, or ventilating it, or neutralizing it. No one suggested that Roman ingenuity could overcome whatever killed there. They respected it. They feared it in the way you fear something that has proven itself dangerous. They incorporated it into their worldview, and they left it alone. They worked around it, built temples near it, created rituals that acknowledged it, made it part of their religious landscape. But they didn't try to eliminate it, didn't try to make it safe, didn't try to rationalize away what everyone could see with their own eyes. Here's where the story darkens, where the pattern becomes too consistent to ignore. The gates of Pluton are not unique. They're not an isolated phenomenon. They fit a pattern, a global pattern, a pattern that spans cultures and continents and thousands of years. Hauska Castle sealed a pit no one could measure, a bottomless shaft that exhaled sounds, that drove men mad, that couldn't be filled or closed, that required a fortress built directly over it, walls facing inward, defenses designed to keep something in, not out. Derinkyu buried entire cities underground, 20,000 people living in darkness, in layers descending hundreds of feet, with infrastructure for months, for years, for generations, all to hide from something on the surface, something that made life underground, in cramped darkness, in constant fear, feel safer than staying in the open world. Hierapolis marked a place where the earth itself exhaled death, where the boundary between living and dead was physical, was measurable, was deadly to cross. Different cultures, different eras, different continents, different threats, different responses. Same underlying behavior, containment, avoidance, ritualized warning, recognition that some places are different, are dangerous, are not fully under human control. None of these places were conquered, none were destroyed, none were eliminated as threats. They were managed, acknowledged, incorporated into human geography, but not controlled, not dominated, not made safe. As if ancient people understood something modern humanity keeps forgetting, keeps having to relearn, keeps paying for forgetting. Some places are not meant to be fixed, not meant to be conquered, not meant to be made safe or useful or accessible. Some places have their own nature, their own rules, their own dangers that don't respond to human engineering or human will. And the smart response isn't to conquer, isn't to control, isn't to eliminate. It's to acknowledge, to mark, to warn, to build around, to incorporate carefully, to respect. In 2013, archaeologists working at the Hierapolis site made a discovery. After years of excavation, years of searching through ruins and foundations and ancient descriptions, years of comparing ancient texts with modern topography, they rediscovered the exact location of the Plutonian, the original gates of Pluton, lost for over 1,000 years, buried under collapsed structures and accumulated debris, forgotten by all but scholars who studied ancient texts. They cleared the entrance carefully, documented every layer of debris, mapped the chamber using modern surveying equipment, surveyed the fault with geological instruments, measured the gas emissions with sensors that could detect concentrations ancient people could only observe through death. And when they did, when modern science, with modern instruments, examined what ancient Romans had observed 2,000 years ago, when they pointed their instruments at the cave and recorded what it was doing, they found something disturbing. Something that validated every ancient source. Something that proved the Romans weren't exaggerating. The animals still died. Not ancient animals described in old texts. Not specimens brought by Romans 2 millennia ago. Modern animals. Contemporary wildlife. Birds flying over the exposed fault in 2013. Insects crawling near the opening in the present day. Lizards basking on rocks near the entrance, unaware of the invisible danger. Birds dropped. Same as Strabo described. Same sudden transition from life to death. Same mid-flight collapse. Insects collapsed. Ants entering the chamber to investigate. Beetles crawling across the stone, all dead within the gas layer, all confirming what the Romans knew. CO2 measurements confirmed lethal concentrations. Modern sensors detected levels that would kill a human in under a minute, levels that matched ancient descriptions perfectly. The gas was still flowing, still pooling, still creating that invisible layer of death. The gate still worked, not metaphorically, not symbolically, literally worked, still killed, still functioned exactly as ancient sources described 2,000 years later, after the fall of Rome, after the rise and fall of Byzantium, after the Ottoman Empire, after industrialization and modernization and all of human progress. The earth had not healed, the danger had not dissipated, the geological forces that created the vent were still active, still releasing gas, still creating the same deadly conditions. The doorway still breathed, still exhaled death into the air, still maintained that boundary between life and death, still enforced its territory, still killed anything that entered unprepared, as if the earth doesn't care about human history, doesn't care about empires or civilizations or knowledge, as if geological processes operate on timescales that make human existence irrelevant, as if the danger the Romans faced is the exact same danger we face today. Science explains how the gas kills. Chemistry textbooks detail the mechanism. Oxygen deprivation, cellular asphyxiation, rapid loss of consciousness, death from hypoxia. We understand the process completely. But science does not explain why this place became sacred, why this particular vent, out of all the vents on Earth, became the Gate of Pluto, why the Romans chose this location to represent the boundary between worlds. It does not explain why priests treated it like a boundary, not a resource. They didn't try to harness the gas, didn't try to bottle it or weaponize it or use it for anything practical. They just acknowledged it, respected it, used it to demonstrate the reality of death. It does not explain why no one tried to exploit it. Rome was practical, pragmatic. If something could be used, they used it. They turned everything into infrastructure, into weapons, into tools. But not this. This they left alone. It does not explain why every ancient culture that encountered places like this, places where the earth did something unusual, something deadly, something inexplicable, reached the same conclusion. Not through communication, not through shared mythology, but independently, separately. This is not ours. This belongs to something else. This is sacred. This is dangerous. This is a boundary. Modern humans see hazards and think control, see danger and think solutions, see deadly phenomena and immediately begin planning how to neutralize, eliminate, contain, make safe. Ancient humans saw hazards and thought boundaries, saw danger and thought respect, saw deadly phenomena and thought sacred, thought this is where we're not meant to go. This is where our world ends, and something else begins. And that difference matters. That shift in thinking matters, because one approach acknowledges limits, acknowledges that humans are not the center of everything, that the world has places and forces and phenomena that don't exist for our benefit, that don't respond to our control. The other approach assumes everything can be conquered, everything can be fixed, everything can be made safe through sufficient engineering and knowledge and will. And history suggests the first approach might have been wiser, might have kept ancient people safer, might have prevented the disasters that happen when humans ignore boundaries, when we assume control we don't actually have. To the Romans, the underworld wasn't metaphorical, wasn't symbolic, wasn't a story told to explain death or morality or what happens after we die. It was geographic, physical, real, beneath, actually beneath, underground, under the surface of the earth, accessible through specific locations, through gates, through doorways, through cracks in the world. Dangerous. Not because it was evil. Not because it was punishing, but because it was other. Because it operated by different rules. Because the living didn't belong there. And sometimes, in certain places, where geology and geography aligned, reachable. Not easily. Not safely. Not by everyone. But reachable. Through places like the Plutonian. The gates of Pluton weren't a story. Weren't a legend. Weren't a myth passed down through generations. They were a coordinate. A location on a map. A place you could visit. A place you could stand near. A place where you could die if you weren't careful. And when you combine that understanding with what we know about other places, other phenomena, other ancient responses to inexplicable danger, a disturbing idea emerges. When you combine the Plutonian with Hauska, with its bottomless pit and sounds from below, and stone doors that only open from one side, when you combine it with Derinkuyu and its hundreds of underground cities, its networks of tunnels, its infrastructure for hiding entire populations beneath the earth. When you look at the global pattern of ancient humans treating certain places as boundaries, as thresholds, as locations where the normal rules don't apply, where danger is permanent, where something other than human exists. What if the underworld wasn't imagined? What if it wasn't invented to explain death? What if it wasn't mythologized from nothing? What if it was experienced? What if it was observed? What if ancient people were describing something real? Not literally Pluto. Not literally Hades with his three-headed dog. Not the specific mythology. But the underlying reality. The underlying observation that there are places where death is more present. Where the boundary between life and whatever comes after feels thinner. Where the earth itself seems to belong to death more than life. What if the mythology was the explanation, the story built around observable fact, the attempt to make sense of places that killed without reason, that breathed death, that couldn't be conquered or controlled or made safe? What if the gates of Pluton weren't named for a god? What if the god was named for the gate? What if Pluto exists in mythology because places like this existed first? The gates of Pluton are no longer used for ritual. No sacrifices. No crowds. No priests demonstrating divine favor. No public ceremonies. No religious significance. The temples are ruins. The altars are broken. The cults are dead. But the gas still rises. Still flows from the fault, still pools at ground level, still creates that invisible layer of death, still kills anything that enters unprepared, still functions exactly as it did 2,000 years ago, will still function 2,000 years from now, unless geological forces change. Still reminds us, if we pay attention, if we observe, if we're willing to acknowledge it, that the earth itself holds places where life does not belong, where human presence is temporary at best, where our control is illusion, places ancient people treated with reverence, not worship necessarily, but respect, recognition, acknowledgement that this is different, this is other, this is not ours, places they marked, built temples near, created rituals around, incorporated into their geography and religion and understanding of the world, but didn't try to conquer, didn't try to eliminate, didn't try to make safe. Places they warned us about, left records about, documented carefully, described precisely, so future generations would know, would understand, would respect the same boundaries. They didn't seal everything, didn't destroy everything. didn't try to eliminate every danger. Some doors they left open. Some boundaries they maintained. Some places they marked and avoided and treated as sacred. Not as invitations, not as challenges, not as things to be conquered, but as reminders, as evidence that the world is larger than human control, that there are forces and phenomena and places that don't respond to our will, that don't care about our engineering or our knowledge or our ambitions, that existed before us, will exist after us, and operate by rules we can understand, but not change. This has been Whispers from the Dark. Season 2. I'm Raven Vale. Some doors are myth, stories told to explain what we don't understand, metaphors for psychological or spiritual truths, symbols that represent ideas rather than places. Some doors are metaphor, teaching tools, ways to communicate abstract concepts, allegories that help us grasp complex realities. And some doors are real, physical, measurable, deadly. Doors you can stand in front of and die. Doors that kill without touching. Doors that prove the boundary between life and death isn't always metaphorical. Still breathing after 2,000 years. Still exhaling death into the air. Still enforcing its territory. Still maintaining its nature, regardless of human presence or human understanding or human desire to control. Still dangerous to anything that enters without knowledge, without respect, without acknowledging that this place has its own rules, its own nature, its own purpose that has nothing to do with human benefit or human safety. Still waiting. Not malevolently. Not with intention or awareness or purpose. But with the patient inevitability of geological forces that operate on timescales measured in millions of years. With the timeless persistence of the Earth itself, waiting for the next person who doesn't believe the warnings, who doesn't respect the boundaries, who thinks modern knowledge makes ancient wisdom obsolete, who assumes that understanding the mechanism means controlling the danger. Waiting to prove once again that some boundaries are real, some dangers are permanent, and some doors should be approached with the same caution ancient Romans showed 2,000 years ago. Still breathing, still killing, still teaching the same lesson to anyone willing to learn, still proving that ancient people understood something important. Waiting.